You're listening to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast. It's for the week ending October 2nd, and it's podcast number 59. Joe Elia here. There's still time, but not much, to take our brief survey, which you can find on our website, podcasts.jwatch.org. The deadline is Saturday, October 3rd. Please help make this a better podcast. Thank you. This podcast has a conversation with the CDC's Diana Blau on complications of 2009 H1N1 infection. A substantial portion of those who've died have had bacterial co-infections in their lungs. First, though, a look at the week's principal clinical news stories. The benefits of treating gestational diabetes are well known, but what about mild cases? Well, it turns out that there are substantial benefits there, too. According to an NEJM study, babies are less likely to be large for gestational age and less likely to present with shoulder dystocia. Their mothers are less likely to require cesarean delivery or to have preeclampsia or gestational hypertension. Next, there's a surprising study out of the UK on the effects of smoking during pregnancy and the later development of psychotic symptoms in mothers' offspring. A group of children followed for 12 years after their mothers detailed their smoking and drinking habits during pregnancy had a definite increase in psychotic symptoms by age 12. Another reason to counsel against smoking. The study appears in the British Journal of Psychiatry. Finally, a story that we'll have an interview on next time. Losing weight in type 2 diabetes has a beneficial effect on obstructive sleep apnea, according to an Archives of Internal Medicine study. Patients given intensive lifestyle interventions leading to weight loss showed significant improvement and, in some cases, remission of their apnea. The bad news, among the controls, even those who maintained a stable weight, sleep apnea worsened over the year of observation. Now, on to the interview. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. The CDC's weekly publication, MMWR, released a report earlier this week investigating the prevalence of bacterial co-infection in the lungs of 77 fatal cases of 2009 H1N1 infection. It turns out that bacterial co-infection isn't rare in this form of influenza. At least it wasn't among these cases, in whom about a third had co-infections. We have as our guest one of the primary contributors to the report, Dr. Diana Blau. Dr. Blau works in the Epidemic Intelligence Service at the CDC in Atlanta. Thank you for talking with me today, Dr. Blau.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you whether you were surprised at the rate of co-infection that you found.
No, we were not, because as in previous pandemics, even before and after the advent of antibiotic use, bacterial co-infections played a predominant part, and especially in 1918 before antibiotics, the majority of deaths were probably attributed to bacterial co-infection.
Earlier reports from this epidemic were saying that, gee, it looks like there isn't much co-infection.
That is correct.
And so your report sort of brings people up short and says, well, you just didn't notice it, but it was there. You don't actually say that, but people are going to have to sit up and take notice now, because this is not as benign an epidemic as everyone hoped it might be.
Right, and the big difference, and if, yes, of course, we're not saying that those reports were wrong. I think a strong point of ours and the fact that we could see it is that we were using different techniques. These were done on autopsy specimens where the antibiotics that the patients were receiving didn't interfere, and these cases or these assays were just a little bit more sensitive. And, I mean, because there's published results that the majority of people that have, or less than 10% of the people that have bacterial pneumonia are culture positive.
Uh-huh.
So our assays are not, we're not saying they're better, but they're more sensitive, especially in these cases.
Many of those who died with co-infection were members of groups prioritized to get the 23-valent pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine, but their vaccination status wasn't known. But would vaccination have prevented at least some of those deaths?
Of course, we cannot say for sure, mm-hmm. but from the data available, they would most likely would have increased or decreased the disease seen by streptococcus.
So in the light of that result, What should clinicians be doing that they might not have been thinking of before this report?
Well, they should discuss with their patients, especially the ones that fall within that 18 to 49 age group, where the coverage is very low on the pneumococcus vaccine. 16% is the most recent numbers of the people that are recommended to get the pneumococcal vaccine. Only 16% receive it. So physicians should talk with their patients that fall within that, those age groups that are increased risk, which would include patients with chronic heart problems or chronic pulmonary problems and diabetes, and encourage them to get vaccination.
And those vaccinations can be given at the same time as the flu shots, is that right?
Exactly. They can be given at the same time.
The editorial note at the end of the piece mentions the use of both empirical antibacterial therapy and antiviral therapy in patients who might have pneumonia. Are those antibacterials the same as the ones recently recommended by the Infectious Disease Society of North America, of America rather, and the American Thoracic Society for a community-acquired pneumonia?
Exactly. Those are the same recommendations put out in the Clinical Infectious Disease article.
Okay.
That you just referenced.
If a clinician suspects that a patient has got pneumonia, according to the IDSA guidelines, they should be treating right away and not wait for lab results to come back.
Correct.
And so that's the case here too then.
Correct.
Are there other treatment resources that the CDC offers in H1N1?
There is on the CDC H1N1 guidance website. I think the important message, too, is to, since the coverage is so low in that 18 to 49-year age group, 16% is the most recent study, and that since the majority of these fatal cases of the 77 series, 81% fell within the adult range, 18 to 59, and that 90% of those 77 had underlying medical conditions that could put them at increased risk. I think that clinicians should strongly encourage patients that fall within the ACIP recommendations for a pneumococcal vaccine to receive that vaccine.
Dr. Blau, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you for getting this important message out.
A final request, please, to take our survey at podcasts.jwatch.org. Remember, there's a $5 gift certificate in it for you. You can reach Clinical Conversations at 1-617-440-4374. Or you can write jelia@nejm.org. Earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where links for all stories can also be found. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. Enough said.